expectation for it, and it leads to mental development and spiritual revolution. In religious expression, good deed is an action which is introduced as obligatory or recommended. You know, we have all heard about the wajib and the mustahab actions, right? They're all good actions. They're good deeds. In moral and mystical definition, though, it is an action by which mystic can achieve esteem position. Therefore, good deed is a qualified action which leads to spiritual development, moral growth, and approaching Allah in every aspect. See, if we make it the goal and the purpose of our life to perform good deeds, see how we're going to benefit from every action that we do. Because at the end of the day, we live in this world, we're going to do things, you know, it's not like, you know, we can just sit idly. Even sitting idly is a deed, if you would, right? Now, if you do it properly for the sake of Allah, every action that you carry out, you can benefit largely through that very action. It could be even sleeping. A good deed is not necessarily when you climb all the way up to the mountain, right? Or do something huge. No, anything that is done properly at the right time based on the Islamic guidelines and for the sake of Allah with that right intention would actually benefit you a great deal. With this, remember, good deeds are easy to carry out. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Srebrenica massacre remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War, more than a quarter of a century later, as new details emerge in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Middle East Eye. The piece is titled, Released Documents Reveal UK Planned Srebrenica Pullout Despite Being Aware of Imminent Carnage. Classified documents show the British government devised plans to withdraw troops from a besieged Muslim enclave at the height of the Serbian onslaught in Bosnia-Herzegovina in July of 1995. Despite being aware of mass killing of thousands by local Serb forces in nearby Srebrenica. Nearly 8,300 Muslim men and boys were later found to have been murdered at Srebrenica after a Dutch contingent of the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force deployed in Bosnia withdrew from the town. The Srebrenica massacre, for which Bosnia's Serb leaders were later convicted of genocide, remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as the UK-based Middle East iNews outlet reveals new details in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The report, which used declassified British government documents about Bosnian crisis, also points to a new widely acclaimed Bosnian movie, Quo Vadis, Ida, that sheds new light on the tragic carnage in Srebrenica and what it described as the catastrophic failure of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the region as Yugoslavia collapsed into war and violence. Quo Vadis, Ida, directed by Jasmila Zabanić, a survivor of the near four-year siege of the major Bosnian city of Sarajevo by local Serb forces, the movie has been nominated as the Best International Feature Film at the 2021 Oscars and as the Best Foreign Language Film at the British BAFTA Awards. According to the released documents, another Bosnian Muslim enclave of Gorazde, where British soldiers made up the main contingent of United Nations peacekeepers, came very close to facing the same fate as Srebrenica. The documents paint a vivid behind-the-scenes picture of Western leaders striving to choose the least worst option presented to them by their advisors, without much regard for the fate of Bosnia's Muslim population facing massacres and other atrocities that were overtly being carried out by Serbian forces. They further revealed that the then British Prime Minister John Major was reluctant to reinforce Gorazde in order to protect his population of more than 30,000, despite, as his private secretary put it, the distressing scenes now daily on our television screens. The documents further show that the British Defence Ministry drafted emergency plans for the evacuation of British troops from the area around Gorazde in July of 1995, at the exact moment that genocidal slaughter was underway at Srebrenica and a third enclave in Zepa had come under attack. Gorazde had come under Bosnian Serb attack in 1994 and again in May of 1995. Gorazde, located on a strategically vital crossroads and surrounded by towering cliffs, was highly vulnerable to another Serbian attack and potential carnage following the fall of Srebrenica and Zepa. The report noted that three eastern towns had been declared safe havens for Muslim Bosniaks by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, after the surrounding territory had been captured by Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serb forces opposed to Bosnia and Herzegovina's declaration of independence in 1992. The report also pointed out that the UN Security Council resolutions had also established that United Nations peacekeepers were only authorized to deter attacks on the three enclaves, but not to protect or defend them. Force could be used only in self-defense. On 16th of July 1995, with a final onslaught against Gorazde thought to be imminent, British plans, codenamed Operation Screwdriver, to evacuate 350 British soldiers from the town of Gorazde was finalised at the Ministry of Defence in London. According to the report, the disclosure of the British evacuation plans came as little surprise to men who served in the Army of Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. It then cited Farid Buljubasic, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Yugoslav National Army before commanding Bosnian forces in Goražde from mid-1992 to the end of 1994, as recalling that the so-called United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, were being led largely by officers who did not understand the nature of the war. Farid Buljubasic recounted that NATO aircraft in 1994 bombed Serb tanks that had already been destroyed. He said, "I would say that the role of the international community in general in Bosnia and Herzegovina was very dishonorable." He further emphasized, "My general impression is that they never understood the character of war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that they were never neutral, that they faked execution of their tasks, and there is so much evidence that they were extremely inclined towards the Serbs." He added, "They ignored and disregarded the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There was politics in all of that." The released documents also make clear that the British Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was determined that the United Kingdom should not be sucked into war with Bosnian Serb forces, and that his senior military commander, Field Marshal Peter Inge, fully supported that decision. Farid Buljubasic further pointed out that a group of 20 British Special Air Service or SAS soldiers had been hurriedly evacuated from Goražde whilst the enclave came under attack in April of 1994. He noted they had been posted to the town as the eyes and ears of UNPROFOR commander Michael Rose, who was himself a British general. Buljubasic added, "When they came, they were pumped up, dressed, they had vests, all sorts of things, camouflage paint. The very moment it got troubling, they vanished." He said, "As the attacks went on, and as the Chetniks or Bosnian Serb forces were getting close to Goražde, one night those SAS, a helicopter came to pick them up. They took their stuff and ran away without letting anyone know, without anything. They just disappeared. They just disappeared and vanished in one night." The former Bosnian commander observed that the behavior of the forces of UNPROFOR, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, would have been identical to the Dutch at Srebrenica, if not even more shameful. Meanwhile, US President at the time, Bill Clinton, was expressing his frustration at the Bosnian government whilst they were struggling to defend themselves amid a United Nations-imposed arms embargo, whereas the Bosnian Serb forces had inherited large amounts of weaponry from the army of the former Yugoslavia. During a telephone conversation with John Major, Bill Clinton was recorded to have said, "We could hardly blame the Dutch for leaving Srebrenica when the Bosnians themselves had already given up the fight." He further claimed, "The Bosnians made a habit of trying to make other people look bad in the press." The report points out that some sections of the British record of these Clinton-Major telephone conversations remain redacted, more than a quarter century later, on national security grounds, following the 2019 declassification of the bulk of the UK government papers on the period. Following the fall of Srebrenica and the attack on Zepa underway, British Prime Minister at the time John Major concluded that Bosnian Serbs would next turn to Goražde, as the British ambassador in Belgrade reported that the Bosnian Serb army was under high after capturing Srebrenica with so little United Nations opposition and was dangerously unpredictable. However, John Major told both French President Jacques Chirac and US President Bill Clinton that he believed only diplomatic pressure should be applied in an attempt to save Goražde. According to the report, the Americans regarded Goražde as a problem for the British and French to deal with and regarded the defense of Sarajevo as a more serious strategic objective. The top British commander in Bosnia, Field Marshal Peter Inge, recommended that if the UK government decided its troops should remain in Gorazda, we should do so as robustly as possible, under a pure peacekeeping and humanitarian mandate option, and then seek a negotiated withdrawal with dignity, as the Dutch have done, but being prepared to use air power.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Salaamun Alaikum. I did it again. And you are annoyed with this, Sister Zainab. Welcome to Youth Station, my brothers and sisters, and all the listeners from around the world, and the things and the species that Sister Zainab knows how to talk to, which I don't. You know, we're living in pandemic.
Yeah.
Feel for once in your life about what you're living. Life has been, you know, strange. I think the best way I could put it out is that life is really strange now.
Oh, man. I mean, I've lived on this green earth many moons. 2020 was on crack.
Yeah. And now just thinking about it, you know, when you watch like videos, not from long ago, 2019, heck, even 2020, the beginning of 2020. And
you're like, wow.
That was our lives.
Remember
we used to
that?
Hug. We used to, you know, come close to each other. We used to whisper in each other's ears.
Yeah.
We used to go out without masks. Wow. So, you know, 2020 to 2021, and hopefully, like, the end is near, hopefully. And that's something that, you know, throughout time, this year that we forgot about actually altogether. You know, it's been like 1 year since I've asked, when is this going to finish?
Yeah.
Because, like, we're just, like, submitted
it's part
to
part of our lives.
Like,
now.
It's not, like, from 100 years till now, we're going to be living in this manner.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think this virus is going anywhere anytime soon.
It's not going, but the thing is that how we, you know, adapt to it, yeah.
Maybe we will just reach a part in our lives that our bodies will develop some sort of like antibody, or our immune system will develop something to just make us immune to the virus. I don't know. Or maybe half of the population of Earth, including myself, would be wiped out, which is part of some sort of plan, you know, thin the herd. But we're living in it now. We can't see the hindsight of the situation, you know?
Is the end near or not?
Or exactly. Mm. Or what the outcome is going to be. Was this a catastrophe? Was it for like some sort of turning point, a milestone in humanity's history? But what do you think? If future generations look back at us now, how would they see our approach? How would they judge our reaction?
I would say that it's a turning point and a catastrophe at the same time. It's a catastrophe that caused the turning point in our lives.
Mm. I differ every day. One day I think
Me
it's
personally,
a catastrophe.
I would
One
like
day,
to emphasize on this that people fought over toilet paper in the United States. Yes, I am stating this to keep on reminding people that as much as we are advanced, we are in technology, some people remain animals.
They do. And just a few weeks back, there were protesting in the States again because of the mandate on masks. They're like, why do you have to force us to put on masks?
Yeah, and look, me personally, the mask thing, you know, it took me time to get used to it.
Me too.
It was hard. Yeah. It was really hard for me.
Yeah, especially because, like, I have a sinus infection and I broke my nose when I was young, so it's crooked. I can't, like, properly breathe through my nose as it is. And imagine a piece of cloth over my mouth at all times. And I couldn't breathe, you know, and it gets humid and your glasses, they fog and...
And not only that, but I don't have a car. I walk. So I go to my lessons back, then back to my, for example, the institute that I work in, then back, and like, for example, come here. And, you know, except for here, I have a car, you know, because they send us a car. Thank you. And I've been, today I was late, and, you know, we got in the kind of flight, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's my fault, but, you know, kind of not my fault at the same time. So, yeah, future generations, when they look at it, I think that they're going to see that we kind of failed in some aspects.
Definitely.
We could have done better.
Better, yeah, yeah.
Especially the beginning. And it was not our fault, huh?
No, it really wasn't.
But
we didn't
failed.
Know how to react.
Exactly. People died from fear. I'm
exactly.
pretty sure I know one person, actually. And
from panic.
From panic. He was
sheer
so afraid.
Panic.
He was so afraid that he was going to die that his blood level started going up and down. The poor guy, his heartbeats, and, you know, with the heartbeats, he needs to breathe, and he can't breathe because his lungs are, you know, infected. And then he, you know.
Died.
Yeah.
May Allah bless his soul.
And not only that, but there was this also ugly factor of countries making fun of other countries and not knowing how to deal with it. I remember still to this day that the States made fun of Qom, especially Qom. That really burns because, you know, all right, I love Iran, but the thing that I love most about Iran, the thing that makes me love Iran is Qom, actually.
Exactly.
Nothing else, sorry about it. Mm-hmm. And Mashhad, of course. Because of Imam Ruth, Ali. That's all my Imam. And the thing is that they took pictures, earlier pictures of, you know, Behesht Masuma. And, you know, they started, oh,
which
look
is
at
a
Iran.
They
don't know how to react. They don't know how to do. Then 1 week, sister. 8 days.
Jahannam broke
New York.
In
New
the
York.
States.
The pictures of the graves in New York were more scary than the pictures of Behesht Masuma. So I think that countries making fun of other countries was kind of, you know, not at its point.
Low.
And, you know, we have, like, presidents calling it the Chinese flu, causing Asian hate.
Yeah, making
like
it racist like that.
Days. Yeah,
exactly. The hate crimes against the Asian minorities, again, in the States. States, please cut it. I feel like the States is like the Florida of the world. You know how you always hear, like, crazy news from Florida and people in Florida? I think that's what the States is for the world right now. Or, like, since forever, the 500 years of history of the United States, you guys have been interesting bunch. Please cut it out. The hate crimes against these Asian minorities. These people probably never even saw China in their entire lives. Some of them weren't even Chinese. They just had those eyes, you know?
The funny thing is that, you know, they're still not 100% certain that this returns to Wuhan.
Wuhan.
It's not 100% certain.
I have so many friends that believe it was just a man-made virus for some sort of...
I don't believe in conspiracy theories, to tell you the truth.
You do
sister.
Or you don't?
I don't.
Yeah.
And I kind of think, you know, whatever happens, whatever, we're living through it at the end
of the
day.
Yeah, I really believe that it happened. And yeah, sure, some people took a whole load of advantage of it and maybe even fueled it. But it was just something that had to happen. Yeah.
Me personally, speaking on a personal basis, my business, you know, aspect, like my academic aspect, which is my business, actually, because I don't have a business.
Oh.
That's my. I translate.
For a living.
That's
academic
what I do.
Academic text
Yeah,
for a living.
Academics. So
you have such an interesting life. I meant that.
I don't know.
In the most sarcastic way possible.
I really wish we could do a TV show one day and that we have, like, live audience and we could see the reactions and how they... And that would be much better than this right now.
Facial
anyway,
expressions are important.
Anyway,
guys.
Hopefully IRIB does this. Anyway, the thing is that I was able to advance myself, move forward
because of the
so
pandemic?
Fast. Because of the pandemic.
Quarantine,
where everything was out. It was like those two-day vacations in the week that I have that I usually use to, you know, go forward or, you know, what peg me back to take it back. Mm-mm. And really just spread out to 6 months. And in this 6 months, I did a lot. And alhamdulillah, I took advantage of it.
There we go, silver lining.
But some people, unfortunately, no. They got the negative part of it. Where their jobs
Yeah.
They lost their jobs.
Exactly. They
Where,
lost
for
their
example,
homes, their job.
They lost a loved one. And,
yeah.
And they, you know, it's really, you know, unbalanced. It became unbalanced. There were some people that really, you know, took advantage of it. And there are people who didn't take advantage
of it. I'm not going to lie, man. Quarantine was bomb. Quarantine was awesome. I loved quarantine. I love quarantine. Like, okay, let's talk about the highlights of COVID-19, ladies and gentlemen. IRIB English Radio special. Quarantine, social distancing. What else?
Sister Zainab is an invert. For those
yes,
who don't know.
I am. I am a hopeless introvert, and I have crippling social anxiety. Don't see me all chatty and bubbly with Brother Habib. I've known him like
6 years.
All his children's life. Throughout his children's life, I've known him. And yeah, we're comfortable, but like, when I'm in public, I'm a grown woman. When I'm in public, I'm still like, I wish I wasn't here. I wish I was in a pandemic, you know? So quarantine, pandemic. At the end of the day, as a woman, I appreciate the mask, you know? Because I don't wear a burqa, but still, I wear this mask and it gets me out of a lot of unwanted, unnecessary situations.
We are slowly falling into Islamic sunnah, mashallah.
Exactly.
Mashallah, all my brothers and sisters out there that are wearing masks.
Working from home was a highlight of it. I loved it so very much.
But that really proved something.
What?
You can't call in sick. There's no such thing as calling in sick. You can work from home.
True. But I could, there were so many meetings, I got to just casually dodge. I was like, no, I'm feeling something, a little body ache since last night. I don't think I should come, you know? It was great.
I did get sick, and I wasn't sure if it was corona or not.
Yeah?
So I had to cancel the program with the producer right here sitting there.
No!
You know, seriously, I didn't know it was corona or not, but I had a runny nose, and I was
a
coughing.
Fever. Oh, no.
I think it was a normal flu, but anyway, you know,
yeah,
so.
Exactly. And something else, another highlight of, once we do a video show of the radio, we should really show the control room too.
Yeah, show the producers
exactly,
as well and the reactions.
Sometimes she's just
we
like,
bash them sometimes and they don't know that we're bashing them.
Sometimes she's like, I'm done with you guys. I regret this immediately.
But they like us. That's a good thing. They can't kick us out.
I think they're stuck with us. It's a pandemic.
They like us because they're stuck with us. They have no other choice. What are they going to do?
Silver lining.
Yes.
Another thing about the Ronas that I feel was a highlight was that people became more aware of hygiene.
Yes, a lot.
Mm. And I think that is wonderful.
Yeah, that's good. We're looking at the positive things now. If we want to look at the negative things, I think we should, you know, it's very hard, you know. Some families,
the economy going sideways.
Yeah, that's really hard to, you know, the effects will be available even if after we finish this pandemic.
Exactly.
If we finish this pandemic.
Ever.
The effects will be playing
this
with
us. This
is
going to take a really long time for
it's not like
world
the Spanish flu.
From.
I don't know why, but the Spanish flu was kind of the effects of the Spanish flu were kind of, you know,
short-lived.
This pandemic is going to be very effective. The rich people got richer
and the
poor
people
got
poorer. Even more poor, yeah.
And
but the thing is, a lot of countries that I know of firsthand, like firsthand experience of those countries that are not totally clean of the Ronas, like New Zealand, some of the Southeast Asian countries, even though like they don't have their Ronas anymore, but they're still practicing protocol. There's some countries like Thailand, if you fly to right now, they're going to quarantine you for 2 weeks. Turkey, but Turkey's not that clean. But then there are other countries that are like experiencing a fourth wave and a fifth wave, and it's like an ocean right now for them. It's a complicated situation.
It really is a complicated situation.
At the end of the
day. It's really going to be in our memory.
Mm.
Yeah.
No. Once it's over, I'm erasing it from my my head's hard
You know
drive.
The thing that really hurts?
What?
I'm looking right now at you and I remember because I see your WhatsApp statuses. and that is, you know, Qasim Soleimani is not available to see this pandemic going on.
Yeah.
You know, and that really just, you know, puts into your mind that the people that passed away before the pandemic, if they were they come back to life, like, what the heck are you guys doing? Why
What's
are all these people doing
the
sunnah now?
Exactly. But it just comes to prove how there is always a silver lining. There's always a blessing in disguise in every situation.
But you have to know how to make
exactly.
use of the blessing. You can know, there are some families, unfortunately, you know, just thinking about those families, like, there came days where they were like so hopeless that what are we going to eat today? What are we going to eat tomorrow? Is there a tomorrow for us? Is there not a tomorrow for us? People's lives change, and it changed a lot. Those who passed away.
Exactly. Like, all the losses. For example, those like, are. We will never recover from that. Yeah. I have a friend. Remember when the bird flu, the H1N1 came? And she lost a brother to the bird flu.
Ooh.
And then she lost another to another, like, it was an epidemic or something. And then the Ronas happened and she lost two sisters to the Ronas. And I was like, I'm sitting here in the luxury of my comfort and my first world problems when there are people who are psychologically, physically, spiritually, financially suffering from this pandemic, whether it's the loss of a loved one or their job or their home. Life as they know it will never be the same again because of something that this pandemic took from them. And I can sit here and talk about the highlights as much as I want because I wasn't directly affected by it. For those who were, I'm afraid there aren't enough highlights in the world that I can point out to them for them to see this pandemic as some sort of turning point. The future generation could look back at our viewpoints, you know, our perspective towards this pandemic and our reaction to it and feel like, y'all were so silly. Y'all were so clueless.
That also depends on the technology that they have at the time. It's like from 20 years from now when they see it, maybe not the technology is not that much as developed, maybe as 50 years and 80 years from now. So they might you know, forget that we're living with the current technology that we have, like in the situation of the Spanish flu and before the Spanish flu.
But one thing we can agree on, no matter how advanced the world and how well-educated the masses, there's a single factor that is repetitive and reoccurring every time there's a pandemic, which is the panic factor. At first, everyone panics.
And that really comes into to the leader's hands. When the leader is calming people down, or for example, you know, some countries where they were hiding the news, it was because they know what they were doing.
Exactly.
And it's not wrong to hide the news in some situations.
Ever. No, in any situation. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen that says the bitter truth is better than the lie that pleases you.
Yeah, so like I'm going to hide it from you for now so you guys don't get scared. I'm going to bring down the numbers. For example, like 3,000 were dying in a day, for example. Oh, let's say like 500 or 1,000. Why? So you won't get too afraid.
But I really admire Ayatollah Khamenei's reaction to it.
I believe that he was the most calm person in the whole pandemic thing right now.
And it was this one sentence that he said really stuck with me, and I found it very beautiful, motivational, inspiring, and hopeful. He said, "It's a serious problem, but it's not a big problem." In an Islamic worldview, there's no such thing as a big problem. And he was right. It's a serious problem. It's taking lives. It's ruining families. But it's not a big problem when your reliance is on Allah.
Yeah.
And you feel that your backup is bigger than any problem life can throw at you.
There were some countries where like they didn't even care at all. There were some countries where they took it too far. Made people fall into fear. And, you know, there were some countries that even lied about the availability. A president, full-grown man, lying about the availability of such a sickness.
And there were some countries that really handled it well. Again, I'm going to say New Zealand as an example.
Yeah.
MashaAllah to them.
See, this also really goes back to the citizens.
Yeah, follow
the guidelines. Because we're all giving the same guidelines. But the thing is that...
Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands.
Yeah, no one is listening.
Exactly.
In some countries,
but
no
then,
one
like,
is listening.
New Zealand and places like New Zealand, Australia, they're really hard to control. That's what New Zealand didn't do. I mean, they had paid leave.
Essential workers are also very vital in this at this time.
And it all comes down to how we've been through our lives. When we reach such a boiling point, how do we react? You know, it's not like we can live our entire lives, whether we are a layman, whether we are a clergy, whether we're a government person, leader lead our entire lives being totally indifferent, not planning for Jack, and then something like this happened, expect ourselves to have a proper and suitable reaction to it. It doesn't work that way. We have to plan our entire lives with discipline and be organized and have a principle. So then when things like this happen, we don't kill each other. That's all the time we have, bro.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're finished. And hopefully the pandemic will finish.
Amin, Ya Rab.
Hopefully. And we could see the sun of a day without masks.
Mm.
And brothers and sisters, I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Thank you guys for joining us. From now until another youth station, me and Sister Zainab signing off. Thank you for joining us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free and made me strong.
In the limelight.
In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. And as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Bernardon J. Wichert, author. This article is published under the heading, Is America Weaker Than China? Stay tuned for more. The United States is no longer qualified to speak to us from a position of strength, said the senior diplomat from the People's Republic of China to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a particularly frosty meeting in Alaska. Much to the Joe Biden administration's credit, it appears to be taking the potential threat that China poses the United States more seriously than it did during the contentious 2020 presidential campaign. Yet one must ask an uncomfortable question. What if China's representatives are correct? As David P. Goldman reports, American influence is fragile in several key Eurasian nodal points, and China has the capacity to hurt the United States in retaliation for American efforts to build an alliance to contain it. In other words, as America spastically pivots to Asia, China swings toward its west. And the reason that China is even attractive to the powers along its western periphery is China's increasing power. Part of the problem is perception. The way that American policymakers measure national power is insufficient for the 21st century. Chinese scholars have developed a much better method to analyze the competitive power of a nation-state. Known as the Comprehensive National Power CNP Assessment, China's methodology for measuring the nation's power relative to those of its competitors helps to explain how China has evolved into a serious challenger to the United States and its allies over the last 30 years. American analysts should study the CNP methodology and apply that when assessing U.S. power relative to that of its competitors. During the Cold War, the Soviets used a similar methodology, which they referred to as the correlation of forces. This kind of analysis would help policymakers devise better strategies for responding to the all-out society challenges emanating from China and elsewhere. One notable version of the CNP comes from Chinese scholar Huang Shougang. Huang's variant comprises a material or hard power index such as economic wealth, natural resources, science and technology, military might. Spirit or soft power index such as political power, foreign affairs, culture, education. Coordinated power index such as line of command, leadership in policy decision making. And finally, environmental index such as international environment. Beyond that, Huang's version of the CNP assessment has an appraisal index system, which includes national strategy goals, political stability, and decision-making capabilities. Huang long argued that the United States would remain the world's preeminent power from 2000 until 2020. He predicted that by 2020, China would be second. This certainly appears to be an analysis conducted over many years by Huang and his fellow scholars of national power at China's Academy of Military Science, AMS. The CNP model notwithstanding, since 2014, China became the largest economy in terms of purchasing power parity, that is PPP. In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. American tech entrepreneurs like Elon Musk believe that China will become the world's largest economy this decade. This is a far cry from a decade ago when many Western analysts were warning of China's coming collapse. There are certainly downsides to China's rapid development that could impinge on long-term growth, although these negative effects have yet to be fully experienced, as evidenced by China's continued growth. And, as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. It all comes down to relative national strength. Yes, the United States has an overwhelmingly strong military on paper, with less than 1% of American population serving in the all-volunteer force at any given time, and with the capabilities of rival powers increasing every year, the question must be asked, how reliable will America's military supremacy be over time? What's more, how potent can America's comprehensive national power remain? The U.S. military itself is highly dependent on technology to amplify its relatively small size. It requires constant additional funding to upgrade its technological accoutrements, and relatively small expediency force is always being stretched. Despite the size of its budget, the military cannot keep up with current force requirements, let alone possibly take on a rising great state competitor like China or, heaven forbid, a coalition of Eurasian powers. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was correct when he cautioned that any future American leader who wants to fight a land war in Eurasia ought to have his had examined. But as China's comprehensive national power grows and ultimately outstrips America's, and if the United States wants to retain its dominant position in the world system, that is precisely what may happen. China's population is becoming more educated in strategically critical fields like science, technology, engineering, and math than are Americans. The Chinese are far more patriotic than their American competitors are. The Chinese infrastructure is more advanced than that of the United States of America. In the hit series Game of Thrones, the treacherous character Littlefinger admonishes the Cersei Lannister that knowledge is power. Yet Littlefinger's actual power, in spite of his vast knowledge, is insignificant. Cersei counters his quip with an actual display of military force, during which explains that power is power. In the 21st century, however, it is clear that knowledge is the basis of capabilities, and greater capabilities allow for greater power over one's rivals. This is the foundation of the CNP assessment and why China's rise over the next decade should worry Americans today.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The necessity for the people to show their cooperation.
Another point which is good to be discussed on the economic matters of the country is that eliminating the problems requires the people's cooperation. If the people enter any area, that area will surely improve. This has been the case until now. Whenever the people entered any area, that area improved. What I want to say is that the people themselves can play a role in investing in production. This includes those who have capital and who use it in some unnecessary business dealings and transactions. They could use their capital for boosting production, and those who want to help others, such as the Pious Help Movement launched during the coronavirus pandemic as all the people participated in it. On the issue of production too, those who are economically well off can create employment for 1, 2, 10 people and help employ them.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The necessity for revolutionary associations and popular charity organizations to enter the arena.
Of course, this requires popular organization. There are many who wish to help, but they do not know how. Charity organizations established by the people, revolutionary associations and mosque officials active in these areas should organize these people so that everyone knows how they can participate with a small contribution. People should not think that everyone should have a billion tuman or more in order to participate in production. Even with small capital, one can help the production of the country. Sometimes, a rural family can be revived and rendered self-sufficient with a few head of cattle. A family living in a city could be rendered self-sufficient with a sewing or weaving machine. Such things can be done in abundance because they help the people, encourage the fight against poverty, and boost production.
Economic siege and sanctions are big crimes.
Now that we are discussing the economy, I wish to raise a point about the sanctions. Of course, I'll return to this discussion later on. First of all, America's economic siege and sanction against us and against some other countries is a big crime committed by a government. Sanctions should not be simply viewed as a political or diplomatic tactic. They're really a criminal activity that they impose sanctions on a nation, with the result being that it cannot import medication and medical instruments, and foodstuff is really a big crime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
And don't fight back! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! The blockade has got to go! Hey, hey!
Going without food may seem extreme to some, but for many Yemenis, it's a part of daily life. After Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in 2015, it quickly moved to encircle the nation, and huge swaths of the country have been facing chronic malnutrition ever since. Now, supporters abroad are refusing food as well, in an effort to draw attention to Yemeni's desperate plight.
We're here outside the White House, where activists with the Yemeni Liberation Movement have gathered to call for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led siege on Yemen. Many of them have decided to put their bodies on the line and are now on day 6 of an ongoing hunger strike in solidarity with the Yemeni people starving under the blockade.
We're here at Washington, D.C. We came all the way from Michigan, and we're in Washington, D.C. to demand an end for the U.S. For the U.S.'s support on the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen, which is causing the biggest humanitarian crisis in the last 100 years. Over 22 million people are experiencing starvation, and every 75 seconds a child dies from starvation.
For the millions deprived of basic supplies like medicine and fuel, every day is a struggle for survival. According to UNICEF, over two-thirds of Yemen's population, or more than 20 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, activists say the U.S. government has been working continuously to enable the Saudi aggression.
So the United States is not only complicit in this genocide, they are wholeheartedly and completely supporting it at every possible aspect, militarily, with intelligence and logistics. They have provided billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in weapon sales to the Saudi government, as well as helping the Saudi government enforce the fuel blockade, which is currently enforced since December 2020.
It's been nearly a week since they've eaten, and going without food is starting to take a toll. But these activists are determined to carry on, saying the situation in Yemen has gotten so bad that they simply have no other choice.
Because it gets pretty foggy and hazy. And I think we're also realizing this is only a fraction of what Yemeni people are having to deal with. So we want folks at home to really understand that.
And I just want to add, you know, so many folks say, like, why are y'all starving yourselves? You know, like, you should be doing something else. And really, it's a last resort. If you look at hunger strikes from, you know, the Irish hunger strike or prison hunger strikes, these are people whose power was taken away, and this is a last resort.
Wyatt Reed, Washington.
After a lull of around 20 months, street protests against Indian-ruled resurfaced in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That came after three suspected anti-India fighters were killed by government forces in an anti-militancy operation on Friday in the southern district of Pulwama. Officials say two of the three men were involved in killing a policeman guarding a local politician's house. Like in past, hundreds of people marched towards the site of the gun battle in support of the fighters. They chanted slogans against the Indian rule in the region. Government forces used tear gas and fired shotgun pellets at the stone-throwing protesters, injuring four people. India imposed a security crackdown on Kashmir after August 5, 2019, when it unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomy. The crackdown, coupled with the COVID-19 lockdown, kept people from taking to streets. Indian officials called the Kashmir unrest, quote, Pakistan-sponsored terrorism, a charge that Islamabad denies.
Pakistan. Through social media, Pakistan is instigating, encouraging, and radicalizing the youth of Kashmir to join terrorist outfits. The youth are fearless and innocent. They don't know what they are doing. Whoever chooses this path should remember the outcome is either jail or death.
A senior journalist and political analyst from Kashmir says there is pent-up anger among people, and this is going to be critical this summer.
A series of laws that have come, including other things which are happening at such a galloping pace. So now people are really trying to express their anger, you know, through one way or the other. You saw the protests in Jamia Masjid, the clashes there. You saw, you know, government degree college in two South Kashmir districts. So I think this summer is going to be very tricky.
Last month, India and Pakistan agreed to abide by their 2003 ceasefire agreement along the de facto borders dividing Kashmir. However, the crackdown by security forces and attacks by militants continue unabated. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan since their independence from the British rule in 1947. The two countries have fought wars over the region and claim sovereignty over it. After witnessing decades of violence, people in Kashmir aim to see a peaceful future. Majority of people living here believe global powers need to play their part before the animosity between India and Pakistan claims more lives here. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The U.S. and Iran will go back to the negotiating table in Vienna to talk about the nuclear deal.
The U.S. State Department made this bombshell announcement on Friday, and it's now the talk of the town. But a high-ranking source in Iran says that Tehran has no such a plan before Washington lifts all sanctions against Iran. Since Biden took office, Iran has made it clear that it is the U.S. that should return to the nuclear deal first, as it was the one that unilaterally and illegally withdrew from the agreement. This stance is shared by Iranian lawmakers as well.
Our leader has put the final word on it. No talks with the U.S. until all sanctions are lifted. After Iran made sure that all of the illegal sanctions are no longer in place, then we would return to our commitments.
There is no point in negotiating to the U.S. while it was the one that broke the international rules and withdrew from the accord. We retaliated by scaling back some of our obligations to the deal, and that's based on Article 35 and 36 of the JCPOA. We have not violated any.